Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 16th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. And today we continue Act 2, Scene 2 with the arrival of the players. Though Polonius announcing the players, their arrival, and Hamlet's request to the first player are usually retained, it is rarer for the first player to actually get to do his long speech. And this is understandable, since the play is already very long and the sequence is very much a digression. That said, it exists for a reason, not only as a trigger for Hamlet's next soliloquy, but as a mirror or lesson related to Hamlet's situation. By discussing the text and adaptations, looking at what was kept of it, it's my hope that we can shed light on certain aspects of the play. The sequence actually starts with Polonius approaching and Hamlet mocking him to his fellow students. That great baby you see there is not yet out of his swaddling clouts, to which Rosencrantz responds, "Happily he's the second time come to them, for they say an old man is twice a child." This banter harks back to and inverts Hamlet's slanders and the idea that the old man would grow younger if, like a crab, he could go backwards. Whether old or young, Polonius is principally ineffectual. Also in play is the concept of the life cycle from youth to old age and back to youth again through having children, possibly, any interruption of which is shown to be unnatural. Consider the murder of Hamlet's father, or indeed of many of the characters, and Ophelia's madness, in which she returns to childhood before even becoming an adult. Life cycles are often discussed in the play, whether it's the king making his way through the guts of a beggar via a worm, or Alexander the Great returning to the earth in the gravedigger scene. Denmark, too, is undergoing a cycle from king to king to Fortinbras, albeit a diverted and therefore unnatural one that replaced Hamlet Jr. with Claudius. Amusingly, in his announcement of the players, Polonius goes through a long list of genres the actors are apparently able to do. A choice should be made by the director and actor here as to whether Polonius is reading from the players' promotional materials or if it's his own opinion. Either way, he shows his tediousness by listing all those genres and genre combos. At this point, Hamlet calls him Jephthah, Judge of Israel. Jephthah is a biblical character in the Book of Judges who rashly vowed to sacrifice the first person to come to his door if God allows him to advance his lot in life, becoming chieftain in this case, if he defeats the Ammonites. He does so, but it's his daughter who comes to the door, and unlike Abraham, his hand is not stayed, and his daughter is burnt as an offering. Polonius doesn't get the reference, but Hamlet knows what he's saying. There's an indication here that Polonius is using Ophelia as a pawn in order to advance or retain his position in the eyes of the king. Hamlet either knows he's been set up to meet Ophelia later or refers to Polonius forbidding Ophelia to see the prince. In any case, Shakespeare makes this little speech a prophetic one, as Ophelia is indeed sacrificed in the course of the play. Enter four or five players. Hamlet welcomes them, references to the lady's voice cracking, point to the Elizabethan rule that no women could be on the stage. Women were thus usually played by teenage boys before puberty made their voices change. Hamlet asks for a speech right away, which is somewhat ironic given his own delayed actions. And he has a speech in mind. He tells the first player, "I heard thee speak me a speech once, but it was never acted, or if it was, not above once." It's almost like Shakespeare is talking to modern directors, knowing this part of the play will, more often than not, be cut for time. It's Aeneas's tale to Dido, specifically when he speaks of Priam's slaughter, and boom, Hamlet launches into the speech himself. It seems Hamlet's thoughts be bloody long before he utters that particular phrase. In the tale from Virgil's Aeneid, he finds allusion to his own situation, the murder of his lord, though the citizenry is far more outraged at the turn of events than Denmark's is. As we'll see, this is not the last idealization of the situation contained in the speech. Hamlet lets the player finish it from that point, but the question here is whether Hamlet is with Priam, the victim king, or with Pyrrhus, the avenger. As a painted tyrant, Pyrrhus stood, and like a neutral to his will and matter, did nothing. Like Pyrrhus, Hamlet is stuck in a moment in time, unable to act, though for him, being painted takes almost the whole of the play. If Pyrrhus is Claudius, however, it becomes completely appropriate to give the usurper, the painted tyrant, here that has a double meaning of falsehood, so to give the usurper a moment of doubt when reenacting the murder, if such a thing is shown in flashback, for example. Despite this hesitation, Pyrrhus then savagely strikes down Priam, again a mix of Hamlet's own idealized revenge and Claudius's unnaturally violent fratricide. Therein may lie Hamlet's dilemma. Can he do what he accuses Claudius of having done, a violent regicide? So the sword now falls on Priam. Out, out, thou strumpet Fortune. So this is the second mention of Fortune specifically as a strumpet, which should be a clue to the audience that Hamlet's situation is linked to this speech. Though the content is largely about murder, you'll note Priam's defenselessness, there is the idea of a tragic destiny also ringing through both plays, whether we're talking about Shakespeare's Hamlet or this rarely performed Aeneic play. Polonius dares interrupt the speech, saying it's too long, which angers Hamlet. Now, Shakespeare seems to know his problem plays problems and seeks to detract critics by acknowledging them in the text. Polonius says here what many in the audience must have thought. What is this digression and why is it taking so long? This pause gives comic relief to the sequence and manages to poke fun at the author while at the same time brooking no criticism. Hamlet's reply puts Polonius and those audience members in their place. The player's speech continues as Hamlet prompts him to get to the good bit about Hecuba, Priam's queen. Hamlet's link to Hecuba is, as with the rest, twofold. On the one hand, he sees himself in her, the grieving family member whose passion would defy the fates. On the other, she's an idealized version of his own mother, what his mother should have been like upon his father's death. But Polonius isn't impressed. He finds the whole business of acting distasteful, and yet was accounted a good actor, or so he claims. Hamlet asks Polonius to make arrangements for the player's accommodations, and the old man says, "I will use them according to their desert." Not good enough for Hamlet. Much better, use every man after his desert and who should scape whipping, use them after your own honor and dignity. The less they deserve, the more merit is in your bounty. Hamlet's heartfelt rebuke stands in stark opposition to his mission and may hold a clue as to the reason for his delayed revenge. Though Claudius, Gertrude, and other conspirators deserve very little, he has vowed to, so to speak, whip them. This line may belie his true nature, which is rather more gentle than it should be to carry out the ghost's vengeance. Hamlet is damned either way. He makes arrangements for the players to play the murder of Gonzago before they exit, so while this sequence is often cut short, some elements need to remain in order to trigger the "what a rogue and peasant slave" speech that follows it, and which we'll discuss in the next episode. But for now, let's see how various directors handled this difficult passage that apparently threatens to make the audience impatient. Branagh finds a number of ways to make sure his audience doesn't grow bored during the sequence. There's a long single take, a one-er, as they call them, that follows Hamlet for what is probably an entire roll of film. Because modern audiences are not likely to know the Iliad or Aeneid, the player's speech is illustrated with silent scenes. And as with many of the smaller roles, Branagh uses stunt casting. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's start at the top of the sequence as Polonius arrives to announce the player's arrival. An announcement that is, of course, redundant, because Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have already done this. Polonius can never be anything but tedious, relating information Hamlet already has. This is also underscored by Polonius reading from the troupe's artistic statement, going through ever more redundant genres.
The best actors in the world, either tragedy, comedy, history, pastoral, pastoral, comical, historical, pastoral, tragical, historical, tragical, comical, historical, pastoral, scene, individual, or poem, unlimited. Seneca cannot be too heavy, nor Plautus too light. For the Lord of Writ and the Liberty, these are the only men. Oh!
Hamlet tries to walk away and takes an actorly voice to mock him when he can't escape. He recites from the biblical story of Jephthah. He puts on voices. He acts out his madness for Polonius. At the same time, he's letting RNG in on the joke, making them complicit in his disrespect of a lord that, while below Hamlet's position, is well above theirs. He certainly has reason to believe Polonius will tattle to the king and queen, so he sows mistrust between the conspirators. Throughout this scene, RNG look like they don't quite know what's happening or if this will wind up costing them their heads. When they next interact with Claudius, we'll see characters desperate to make their case and a king who doesn't care to listen. They probably think they've been compromised by their friendship with Hamlet. It's doubtful Claudius even registers their presence by that point. As for Polonius, he is visibly irritated by Hamlet's performance and distracted by it. He fails to recognize what lies under the Jephtha illusion. You know, this might be another way to further elevate the Puritan Hamlet from the corrupt court, if Polonius doesn't know his Bible. The players then come in, and to respect the time period used by Branna, the girl who should watch her voice lest it crack is played by a little girl, not a boy. Hamlet is teasing her. We do get the sense that the entire family is on tour. It immediately makes us compare this family to Hamlet's, and indeed, the player will be king on stage, the lady, queen, and another actor will be the assassin. They seem happier, of course, and only play at tragedy. The point of this sequence is to show actors having more sincere feelings than real people do. So there's that mirror there as well. Later, Hamlet will ask his mother where her blush is. Claudius will pray and not mean it. Hamlet swears revenge but can't follow through. So here we have an actor who shows great passion in a speech about fictional characters. If Shakespeare teaches us anything, it is to feel. His characters do, and through the poetry, they describe those feelings and make them real. And so in the play, it is the actors who similarly teach Hamlet how to feel. Hamlet himself is an actor. He plays the role of the madman. And this becomes more literal in this sequence as he starts reciting the speech he asks from the first player. If the speech was never acted, or only once, as Hamlet claims, he certainly has a strong memory of it. We're reminded that we're in the presence of a great mind. Branna has fun with it, though, with even the kids knowing some of the speech's punchlines.
Head to foot now is a total goose!
He's finally taken out of his performance by the sight of his own hand holding an imaginary dagger, an invisible reminder of the task ahead. The first player is played by Charlton Heston, a choice Branna says he made to properly show that the player is a legend of the theater. And indeed, Heston has that screen presence. And it's probably his best performance ever. It blew me away and is one of my favorite things about the film. If his casting evokes a legend of the acting world, his speech is also about a legendary character. And these are played by true legends of the stage in the live-action illustrations. Priam is played by John Gielgud, Hecuba by Judi Dench. Could it get any better? Their small roles are still a challenge as they must show a great deal of emotion in a completely silent performance. Though they are not strictly seen by the other characters in the play, they make the same point the player does. Actors showing a great depth of emotion, and once again, in an idealized king-queen configuration.
Fellies from a wheel and pull the round nave of heaven as low as to the fiends.
This is too long.
The player's speech is interrupted by Polonius, and comically, the music also stops and starts in between his interventions. Tension mounts between Hamlet and the old counselor until he gets his wrist slapped at the end. It's what he gets for showing evident dislike and disrespect to the players. As the party breaks up, Hamlet sends RNG away, and for some reason, Horatio is now included, having come in with the players. He has no lines, but Hamlet gives them a secret signal to go with them and keep a close eye on them. Perhaps it was felt Horatio had not appeared in too long a time. Other directors have made him a silent witness to all of RNG's scenes, so his presence isn't unwarranted. In Olivier's version, the players only appear after Hamlet has his arranged encounter with Ophelia and the to-be-or-not-to-be speech. It occurs in a different moment altogether, a dark one for Hamlet, who is meditating on suicide at this point in the film. Olivier's flights of expressionism thus cast Hamlet in a dark space. Symbolically, Polonius walks in with a torch that illuminates the prince, and when the players come in the room with many torches, it seems to fill the night with light. Polonius's arrival and subsequent announcement of the players gives Hamlet the glimmer of an idea, a new sense of purpose, all of it expressed with lighting as much as acting. Polonius reads from a parchment. Felix Aylmer is as amusing as usual.
The best actors in the world, either for tragedy, comedy, history, pastoral, pastoral comical, historical pastoral, tragical historical, tragical comical historical pastoral.
In the absence of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, there is a certain irony to Polonius being the bearer of news that will undo him and his corrupt king. From the player's entrance, Hamlet enters a manic state, delivering lines at a furious pace, often preventing anyone from interjecting. This will be a much shorter scene, heavily cut and missing the Priam speech. I am glad to see thee well is spoken to a dog walking on its hind legs, eliciting some laughs. The lady is an historically accurate boy. The player who recently grew a beard is first player, which makes the character younger than he appears from casting. A mirror of Hamlet's own doubtful age, maybe? Of course, it could just mean he recently grew a beard, but the text does mean to refer to an actor getting older. Harcourt Williams, who plays the first player, was already in his late 60s. Olivier preys on expectations when choosing his line's targets to create an amusing effect, but doesn't really squeeze extra meaning from the text. Since there is no recital, Hamlet quickly asks them to follow Polonius, and as they go, so does the light. However, Hamlet is now facing front, a reversal of his initial position. He's ready to take a step forward, the play within the play, moving away from the introspection and back and forth that has been the crux of the play since his silent visit to Ophelia. In his reconfigured sequence, Olivier loads Hamlet's inaction at the front end of the play, rather than allow ambivalence in the middle part, where Hamlet has thought up the plan, but seems still unsure before enacting his guilt-revealing scheme. It's certainly more efficient that way. The BBC version provides us with a very different take on the first player's speech, but before we get there, Polonius must announce the player's arrival. As he attempts to do so, Jacoby's Hamlet continues to mess with him. He puts on voices, reads along with the scroll in a show of boredom, throws himself to the ground in worship, imagining Polonius to be the revered figure of Jephthah, and waves his hand in the air with the meter of his quoted lines. This whirlwind of activity confounds Polonius, of course, but sets the tone for the player's arrival. Hamlet is a showman, like they are, and the sequence draws strong parallels between the prince and the people who may play at being princes. As they enter, juggling torches and tumbling, Hamlet indulges in a bit of stage fighting using wooden swords, prefiguring the play's finale, in which he also fights a friend. Hamlet is being bearded by the first player, a man older than he is, played by Welsh actor Ambrose James. He's the vampire Ocon to Doctor Who fans that same year.
Welcome all! I am glad to see thee well!
Welcome, good friends! Ah, my old friend. Why, thy face is balanced. Since I saw thee last, comes thou to beard me in, gentle. But my young lady and mistress, by our lady, your ladyship is nearer to heaven than when I saw you last, by the altitude of a chopin. Pray God your voice, like a piece of uncurrent gold, be not cracked within the ring.
No!
Masters, you are all welcome.
The bearded line usually indicates the actor being spoken to is younger or as old as Hamlet himself, someone who has grown a beard, which is to say gotten older from boy to man, since Hamlet last saw him. Subverting the line at once confuses Hamlet's age further and makes us think of the line in more metaphorical terms. I become less interested in the fact that the first player is newly bearded and more in Hamlet's assertion that the player would top him in some way. He doesn't beard him by being more hirsute, but rather by being more emotionally available, and by doing more to reveal the king's treachery with a single scene in the Mousetrap, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself, than Hamlet has managed to since the start of the play. Bearded to mean outdone. Hamlet next addresses the lady of the group, and in line with the production's medievalism, she is played by a boy who proves his voice has not cracked by singing a clear la. These fun bits are followed by Hamlet's attempt at the speech, which showcases the strong chemistry between him and the first player. The player goes beyond his lines by harumphing here, nodding there, guiding Hamlet through the start of the monologue. He is Hamlet's guide, a telling fact. Jacoby makes less of a meal of it than Branagh does, but at the end of the speech still gets applause. He graciously accepts it, though he mockingly curtsies to Polonius when the counselor offers appreciation. When Polonius later interrupts, he does so less brazenly than Briars does in the 1996 version, leaning in on the word ear and confiding his comment discreetly, but he draws no less anger from the explosive Hamlet. As long as we're making comparisons, Heston's player definitely has more gravitas, while James's emotions are more overt and desperate, bigger and thus more theatrical as opposed to cinematic.
The instant burst of clamor that she made, unless things mortal move them not at all, would have made milch the burning eyes of heaven and passion in the gods.
The speech ends with the player's hands on his face, but when Hamlet takes them off, he's all smiles. And yet he sniffles through the rest of the scene. The faked trappings of grief still require a certain measure of truth. Where James shines as the player, however, is in how he milks the awkwardness of Hamlet's outbursts against Polonius. The player is slightly amused, but still respectful. He takes sides in the most subtle way possible. An example Polonius might have been smart to follow, but Polonius's love of his own wit prevents him from ever being like the player. He doesn't know his place, and he'll suffer for it. As the party disbands, Hamlet pulls a wooden sword on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, providing them with one last scare. They hand him his book back, but he leaves them hanging by not taking it back. The staging here drips with sarcasm, and their welcome to Elsinore is anything but heartfelt. Structurally, Zeffirelli's version continues to distance itself from other Hamlets. The players are not, in this case, announced by Polonius. Pete Postlethwaite, the first player, arrives with his troop, wagon, and pack animals, interrupting Hamlet and RNG's gloomy picnic. They are dirty medieval peasants, and come with circling seagulls that evoke the stench of humanity and the garbage it leaves behind. Does this work against the play's intent? In a way, it does, reducing the player king's mirror nobility, which one could argue should outshine Claudius's. It seems to comment negatively on the players themselves. On the other hand, it draws parallels with the worm-eating beggar of Hamlet's parable, widens the divide between the pampered nobility of the court and the rotting Denmark that's out there, supports Polonius's impression that they deserve less, and when the mirror is finally held up to the king, intensifies the irony. In any case, Hamlet is ebullient and calls them masters. The scene then cuts to Hamlet entering Elsinore with the troop, wearing a costume and playing music. He is part of this troop, and their festive joy is contagious. Even the villains are smiling and laughing. This is how things could be between Claudius and Hamlet, if not for the regicide that stands between them. Again, irony is intensified, and one could even imagine a reading of Hamlet in which Denmark is not rotting because its king is corrupt, but rather because it hangs on its true ruler's every mood, by which I mean the prince, just as Gertrude does. Denmark is in a sorry state because Hamlet is depressed, and here the entire population shares in his moment of joy. When Hamlet falls, so too does Denmark at the hands of Fortinbras. It's Denmark as Hamlet by way of Gertrude as Denmark. We're told she lives and dies by his looks, and so too does the country. It's an interpretation that could be used to explain how she knows so much about Ophelia's suicide. She's the river as much as she is the rest of the land, and it turns the closet scene into a public accusation, forcing an entire country to face the fact that they happily let a pretender on the throne. And after all, if Claudius is not the rightful king, and perhaps the prince is not ready yet, shouldn't the queen actually be ruler? That this scene evokes all this makes me forgive its savage cutting of the player's speech, and indeed Hamlet's own. We go from the player's arrival directly to, "Will you see them well bestowed?" And this is a massive cut, and Polonius's late entry in this means Hamlet need not be angry at the counselor's comments either. His retort, "Who shall escape whipping?" is said with wit and a pleasant measure of sarcasm, but not anger.
"Use every man after his desert, and who shall escape whipping?"
Polonius hasn't deserved any anger. He hasn't interrupted or criticized the player's speech. Hamlet then announces they will hear a play tomorrow night, though the exchange between him and the player is not shown. We might infer, knowing the play as we do, that Hamlet and the player devised the mousetrap on the way to the castle. But that will not be apparent to the uninitiated. It seems strange to us that Zeffirelli would try to hide a 400-year-old plot point, but he is evidently crafting an accessible Hamlet for a large movie audience who might not know this story, playing out its twists and turns as surprises. Indeed, this was my first Hamlet. This is the first Hamlet I ever experienced before even reading it. It's only after all this that he confides in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern that he is only partly mad, moving the line from the end of the previous sequence to the end of this one. In its new position, and with the king and queen now part of the sequence, the line acts as a loyalty test. Hamlet makes like he's leaving, but pops his head back out to watch RNG run to the king and tell him everything that's just gone between them and Hamlet. This confirms their treachery and acts as a precursor to Hamlet's confirmation that Claudius is likewise a villain. So again, though Zeffirelli plays fast and loose with the text, he replaces it with informative visuals. I'm glad we're doing this because the film actually benefits from this closer reading. In Fodor's experimental Hamlet, Polonia walks into the room to announce the player's arrival. She seems disinterested and impatient in a way that reminds me of Much Ado About Nothing's Beatrice taking pleasure upon a knife's point.
My lord, I have news to tell you.
My lady, I have news to tell you. When Roscius was an
actor... The actors have come hither, my lord. The best actors in the world, either for tragedy, comedy, history, pastoral, pastoral, comical, historical, pastoral, tragical, historical, tragical, comical, historical, pastoral, scene individual, or poem unlimited.
Hamlet and Horatio openly hate her. As she goes through the player's list of qualifications, it sounds like sarcasm, but it goes on so long, Horatio seems to wonder if she's for real. And then the players come in. Electronic music blares, the picture is polarized, we're in an 80s music video, the self-satisfied Polonia smiles and seems to think they're super cool, she blushes and fans her face, our three players, two men, one woman, all sizzlingly intense, are hot, they're radioactive, and it certainly seems like Polonia has fallen under their spell. It's the sycophant in her. Just as she's latched onto the king and the power he represents, so does she succumb to the player's star power. In fact, everyone does. Hamlet is up and excited, Horatio smiles expectantly, the prince asks for a speech, and the players merely stare at him impassively. It's this uncomfortable moment that may prod Hamlet into starting that speech himself. Horatio smiles kindly at Hamlet's attempt, encouraging where the players are really not. They're actually rather sinister. As Horatio becomes more and more apprehensive about the player's non-reaction, which is a complete inversion of the emotional player that gives Hamlet reason to soliloquize in other versions, the prince recites his portion of the Priam speech with smiles. He enjoys the words, but doesn't perform them as other Hamlets do.
The rugged Pyrrhus, he whose sable arm, black as his purpose, did the knight resemble, when he lay couched in the ominous horse.
Polonia applauds him for it, one might say sarcastically. The players move to a carpet that will act as their stage and face each other. Horatio shares a gleeful smile with Hamlet at their eccentricity. As Hamlet places himself in the center, the players start to walk around him in various directions, reciting what sounds like the prime speech in German, sharing lines among them. The soundtrack has the quality of chanting monks. The bizarre ceremony sends Hamlet into a flashback sequence featuring his father's funeral as each character, in turn, kisses the corpse on the lips. A cacophony of bells, children's laughter, and German words score this seance, which conjures up the oft-seen spirit of the child Hamlet. And this time, a shocked Horatio sees him too, even touches him. She leaves the silent but laughing child to go and support the adult Hamlet as he comes out of the trance and feels faint. Hamlet then gets a clear vision of the players, matching each one with the role of king, queen, or ghost. And we understand how and when Hamlet gets the idea for the mousetrap. He goes on to ask the first player to play the murder of Gonzago. Now, this is a very strange sequence, and it doesn't really work for me. It fits the horror story aspect that Fodor tries to bring out of the play, but it robs us of Shakespeare's words and their intended performance. What we have instead is creepy German performance art, confusion where, ironically, things become clearer for Hamlet. His lost childhood appearing to Horatio in the flesh isn't explained, nor can it be. An important thing to remember as we get into this section with the Tenet version is that this adaptation placed Hamlet's meeting with Ophelia and To Be or Not to Be before this part, not after. In other words, the relationship between Hamlet and Polonius is different. The older man has just seen his daughter violated, and Hamlet knows her father was spying on him and used Ophelia to betray him. This gives the metaphor of Jephtha more resonance. In the play, as usually structured, it comes off as playful if prophetic mockery. Here, Hamlet has a right to say it in anger, and it becomes bitter reproach, though Polonius still fails to get the reference. The minor cuts made to the exchange, like the rest of the pious chanson, make this more plain, and Hamlet simply snaps Polonius's tie instead, and that follows not becomes an overt comment on Polonius's parenting skills in response to a daughter I love passing well.
Am I not in the right, old Jephtha?
If you call me Jephtha, my lord, I have a daughter that I love passing well.
Nay, like follows.
Not only does Polonius's response not follow Hamlet's setup, but it is not coherent with his behavior as a father. Polonius is right to enter the scene already on the defensive, though he distractedly forgets about the danger once he gets into defending the player's quality. This Polonius gets lost in the possible genre combinations theater might produce and is unready for Hamlet's attack. The player's entrance, heralded in the previous sequence by car horns, suffers minor trims. The beard me comment, for example. But Hamlet still welcomes my young lady. This character is a grown man, and the idea of his cracked voice is a good joke. Hamlet then jumps on a trunk and starts the Priam speech, but he doesn't remember the words as well as some other Hamlets do. There is a lot of prompting from the entire troupe, played for comic effect.
The rugged Pyrrhus, like the Hyrcanian beast, it's also, it begins with Pyrrhus, the rugged Pyrrhus.
He whose sable
arms, black as his purpose, did the knight resemble. When he lay couched in the ominous horse.
Hamlet is a surprisingly bad actor here, doing many of the things he complains bad actors do. Sawing the air with his hands, for example. Though it makes Hamlet more believable, at least by our 21st century standards, I'm not sure this layer of irony helps the play. Though he may not be a trained actor, the Hamlet of the play is still a consummate one, creating a vast performance for all of Elsinore. Not that this take on it is actually incoherent with the text. Hamlet may know what he likes in theater and still be unable to render it himself. The scene is a very human one in which the prince gets prompted so many times he abandons his attempt and lets the real actors finish, sitting on the floor like a child. Despite Hamlet's many hesitations, Polonius, ever the sycophant, raves about the performance. Hamlet shushes him rudely. While the players are played by actors who hold other small parts, like Rinaldo and the priest and so on, just like they do in most theater productions, the first player is played by the great John Woodvine, who has no other role, nor should he. Woodvine mimes some of the actions described in the speech and uncovers some of the play's themes through judiciously placed pauses. He talks of a painted tyrant, which brings us to the just-mentioned images of Claudius sold to the population. He plays Pyrrhus' moment of doubt, with the sword sticking in the air, putting Hamlet squarely on Pyrrhus' side. Hamlet is a hesitating avenger, like Pyrrhus, which makes the pitiable Priam Claudius, and poor Hecuba Gertrude. In that moment, might Hamlet's doubts seem to stem from an inability to hurt his mother by twice widowing her? In this scene, I usually see an image of Claudius killing Hamlet Sr., and an ironic reverse of both Claudius and Gertrude's actual attitudes. But Woodvine manages to create a different picture, one that creates even more doubt. Doubt that must be resolved through the mousetrap. In the end, the players are sent off to their quarters with Polonius, but Rosencrantz and Guildenstern stay behind. Hamlet, eager to unpack his heart with words, curtly dismisses them, his attitude belying his words of welcome. He shows them the way out, purposefully forgetting his previous accusations and leaving his conflict with them unresolved. He dismisses them and their subplot as unimportant, as he is seized by a different impulse, a small but telling example of Hamlet's breaking with dramatic rules as he continually expands his self beyond the play's boundaries. Finally, we look at Classics Illustrated. For the original comic, it's plot, 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 plot. It's driven by it rather than poetry or emotion. It's a natural byproduct of the stiff and expressionless art and the page count. But as it decompresses certain scenes, I'm not sure that's as important an issue. The important thing here is that the players arrive at Elsinore and that Hamlet asks them to play a modified version of The Murder of Gonzago. And that's exactly what we get in just two panels. Of interest is that Hamlet sits king-like through the entire sequence. Gone is his enthusiasm for theater. It's not set up with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who have yet to appear. So he doesn't attempt a speech himself, nor does he ask one of the first player. The players are not old friends here. They're just subjects to be commanded. There's a musician in orange who seems particularly unhappy about Hamlet's choice of play, and this sourpuss will end up playing the assassin. Unlike the live play, in which we might seek and find the moment Hamlet thinks up the mousetrap scheme, the comic gives us no indication. Hamlet is calm and collected. He seems to have the plan in his head before he ever meets with the players. Not to say Tom Mandrake's adaptation does much better, even though the action has been stretched to, a third panel. He restores the idea that the players are old friends, but things move so fast, he must have had the idea for the mousetrap long before they arrived. The cuts are not kind to this sequence and make several lines lose their meaning. Buzz Buzz, for example, is no longer used to mock Polonius's redundant news, but it still works as a kind of interjection. Comest thou to beard me, however, loses something in the translation. The first player doesn't even have a beard. The line is a complete non sequitur. It's also not clear if Polonius heard Hamlet ask for the insertion of lines. He's very close, but his silhouette is walking away from Hamlet in that second panel. Both comic book adaptations fail to do this sequence justice. So we lose some of the impetus for the whole play within a play scene. Hamlet is not inspired by the first player's passion, nor does he come across as a particular fan of theater, though only such a fan might have thought of the mousetrap gambit. The players have to show up because Hamlet needs them to enact a play that might reveal his uncle's guilt. We see here how reducing one of Shakespeare's plays to plot points proves an unsatisfying enterprise. And that ends our look at Act 2, Scene 2, Part 5. Next time, Scene 2 ends with Hamlet's final speech at the close of the second act. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com, leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 2, Scene 2, Part 6. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I.
Rest is silent.